Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. August in Tulsa is not for the faint-hearted. And for me, a week earlier this month in the mountains of Colorado is the one thing sustaining me through this heat and humidity-filled month. As summer begins to come to a close, today on Studio Tulsa, we hear from a writer who has spent most of his life in the great outdoors. And whether you, too, were able to get away or you were stuck here in town, Peter Heller offers you an outdoor adventure late summer read in his novel, The River. Heller is an expedition whitewater kayaker who's tackled some of the most inaccessible and forbidding streams around the world, in Tajikistan, Tibet, Central America, and the Peruvian Andes, which he's written about in National Geographic Adventure, Outside Magazine, and Men's Journal. So it's only natural that his novels also have an outdoor theme. That's true of his previous novels and his latest, The River. The River follows two close college-age friends, Wynn and Jack, as they make their way down a northern Canadian river, down the Canadian Shield to Hudson Bay. Their river run, done without most of the conveniences of contemporary wilderness adventures, goes awry almost from the start, as a whiff of smoke eventually reveals itself as a major fire, throwing a couple of shady characters and a man who says he lost his wife in the wilderness, and soon the adventure becomes a story of survival. I spoke with Heller back in March. His book, The River, is published by Knopf. Peter Heller, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great being here.
The River is a page-turning wilderness survival story set in a river country of northern Canada as two college friends, Wynn and Jack, take this paddle trip north to Hudson Bay. Now, what were the thoughts behind the start of this story? You've written a lot of novels based on some of your outdoor adventures, and it sort of has an outdoor theme to a lot of your novelistic writing. What was the inspiration behind the story?
Yeah, well, there were sort of two origins to this novel. I never know what I'm going to write until I sit down to write it, because I wrote so much nonfiction. I wrote for, you know, magazines, especially outdoor magazines like Outside, National Geographic, for many years, doing expedition writing and environmental writing. And I always knew what was going to happen next, and I always knew the ending. And so when I finally got to writing fiction, I just wanted to start with the first line and just go and wing it, you know, and have it be sort of like a river expedition where you just come around a bend and, you know, you don't know what's going to be there if you've never run it. And, you know, I kind of started with the first line, but pretty quick, my characters were on this river that was a lot like, if not exactly the same, as a river called the Winisk in northern Ontario that runs into Hudson Bay. And it was an assignment that I took a few years ago to canoe this thing, and I invited the gal I was dating. We just started dating, and it was sort of our first big date. And, you know, it was like a three-week, really remote river trip with whitewater and really wild country with, you know, wolves and bear and, all sorts of stuff, northern lights. And it was a beautiful, beautiful trip, and I think it, you know, it must have really stayed in my heart because, you know, that's where I put these guys, unbeknownst to me that I was going to do that. And the other thing was, when I was 17, I was in love for the first time, and it was at a boarding school in Vermont, and my girlfriend was from New Hampshire, next door, from the country, and she was an equestrian. She was a good rider, and her mother lived in a little cedar shingled farmhouse above a lake on the edge of the White Mountains, beautiful Mount Jacaro across the lake, and I just thought it was the greatest place on earth. We go there for the weekend sometime, and I remember one October weekend, she had three older sisters, and her mom was single, so that on the weekends, the suitors would come out of the hills and friends, and everybody was broke. You know, everybody was students or musicians, and, you know, nobody had much money, so we'd have these big spaghetti dinners and, you know, wine, and I, you know, at 17, this to me was like paradise. And one evening, I saw this guy leaning against the wall looking kind of sad and charismatic. And he was in his late 20s. Somebody said, "Hey, that guy makes his living in a canoe." And my ears kind of swiveled, you know. I was like, "Oh, that's what I want to do." I walked over there and I said, "Hey, what's up? You look kind of rough." And he said, "Well, I lost my wife 2 years ago." My jaw kind of dropped. And I said, "What happened?" And he said, "Well, we were..." He was a geochemist, and they take these canoe expeditions up in Labrador studying rivers. And he said, you know, we were on one of these, and in a remote place, she went over the berm one morning to go to the bathroom, and I never saw her again. And I was, like, stunned. I said, "Well, was there a bear sign? Was it a bear attack?" He said, "Nope." "Did you look? Did you search?" "Yep, for days." And I walked away from that conversation, and I knew he was lying. I mean, my antenna were humming, and even at 17, I knew that. And I thought, you know, that guy killed his wife. That's what I thought. And I must have been thinking about that for like 40 years, because when I sat down to, you know, I put these guys on this river that I love, but then, you know, as the story unspooled, that was the story I was trying to tell.
Yeah, I was struck by your first line you were talking about. Yeah, I just sat down, I wrote the first line, and the first line of the book is, they'd been smelling smoke for 2 days. And of course, the first adventure these two characters who are running this river run into is the fact that very quickly on into their journey, which they sort of design as a throwback trip, you know, without a lot of modern conveniences right. that we would have when we take an expedition like this, they realize there's a big forest fire to their west. And immediately they're trying to calculate, well, do we make it back to civilization before the fire hits the river? Are we going to be in trouble? And there's always this lurking in the back of their mind through almost the entire book.
Yep.
Have you ever experienced that feeling of a fire up close where you're not in a position where you can easily get out of harm's way?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, that was, you know, fiction's funny like that, you know, what you put in there. And it's always those things, as I said before, that make this deep impression on you and you, that you don't even realize that you're sort of thinking about and turning over. In 1994, July 6th was the Storm King fire west of Glenwood Springs,
yeah, right.
where those 12 guys died. And that same weekend on July 4th, you know, it was terribly dry conditions. On the other side of Grand Mesa to the south, I lived in Paonia, not very far away. Mm-hmm. And I was done writing one morning, and I went outside, and I saw a column of smoke down the valley. And I thought, gosh, that looks, you know, it looks like a lightning strike, and it looks like it's pretty near Chuck's. So I, good friend, so I threw a shovel and a chainsaw in the truck, and I drove down there, and at the base of the hill by the feeder canal, the irrigation canal, were all the fire trucks and police cars and everything, and they said, you can't go up there. You know, it was a rough dirt road up the slope. And I said, well, that's my friend, and so I just grabbed a shovel, and I jogged up, and by then, you know, there was a wall of smoke sort of over the pinyon junipers, and everybody was like tamping down. Sparks were hitting the duff and igniting. We were like putting those out, and people were running to cars with, there were like six vehicles up there, running to cars with art and laptops, stuff like that. And cats, Claudette, C-L-A-W, Claudette, I put her in my car, in Chuck's truck. And then this gust blew, and that wall of smoke became a wall of flame, and I'll never forget it. I heard the trees exploding and all of that, and the volunteer fire guys that were there with their trucks, you know, were out of here, and they cut their hoses, and we made this line of cars, and I was in Chuck's big old Harvester International. It's like a 1950 truck, really loose jointed, bouncing down this road with a cat hauling the mail, you know, back and forth in the cabin. And we drove down through smoke and then sparks, and then, you know, the flames were really close. And we got to the down to the bottom where everybody was and looked back, and 90 seconds later, that fire took that whole hillside. So, we're, you know, it was that close. And, you know, I think it really impressed me.
And there's a line in the book that Jack, one of the characters, says, you know, I've always heard fires talk. And he was, at this point of the novel, the fire is talking to them.
Yeah, yeah, and more than talking. I mean, it's, you know, it has its own animus in the book, and I think, you know, the one that I experienced seemed to, you know, it seemed to be, have its own agency almost, and that made it even more terrifying.
Well, I know you've had a lot of adventures in your life. You've whitewater rafted some of the most incredible places on this earth, Tibet and far Asia. These two young men, as I said earlier, they're taking this throwback trip. You know, they're not taking the sat phone. They're not taking some of the precautions. And it reminded me a lot of ways of, I remember reading an account of journalist Eric Severide when he was a young man. He just graduated high school, and he took a canoe trip from Minnesota, I think somewhere right around Minneapolis or St. Paul, all the way to Hudson Bay.
Wow.
And then I read that he wrote a book about it, and it's a really amazing book. But during the 20s and 30s, it was very much more common for young men to sort of as a way of testing themselves, taking these, you know, it might be riding the rails for, you know, six
yep.
months, or it sort of reminded me of this sort of story, sort of a testing, sort of testing Darwin.
Well, you know, these guys, they don't think of it that way because they're much too humble. I mean, they're not, you know, they don't have a lick of grandiosity between them, and they, all they want to do is just, you know, they love rivers, they love mountains, they're best friends, they both love books, you know, especially outdoor adventure, Louis L'Amour westerns and poetry and classics, you know, they love to fish. And what they really want to do is, because they've been students, they've been working their whole lives also, they just want to take a break. They've earned some money as guides over the summer. They took the fall term off, and they don't set an end date on this trip. You know, for the otter to fly into Wapak, which is the Cree village on Hudson Bay, kind of famous for polar bears, they don't set a date for that flight. They just figure, you know, they'll take it when they get there. They don't even bring watches, as you said, you know, just because they want to get into the rhythm of the days and the nights. And just kind of pick blueberries and fish and hunt a little if that happens, and read and sit by the fire and talk and watch the weather. That's the kind of trip they wanted to take.
But it doesn't happen that way. Unlike your trip down the Winnisk River, which sounds like it was very picturesque, it is picturesque, but there's a sense of fear and survival from virtually the very first pages.
Right, fun. I think there's multiple threats. Early frost, you know, winter can overtake you up there, and it has overtaken expeditions and killed people. And, you know, early winter, I know they had a hard frost right away at the beginning of the book.
Yeah. These two characters, as you mentioned, they have these complementary interests, but in other ways, they're very different people. Tell us about these two characters, Wynn and Jack. Is there something particular about these characters that made you write them the way they were?
Yeah, I mean, I think Jack is from Western Colorado near Kremling, and he's a ranch kid. He's a tough ranch kid. You know, he spent half his life in the saddle, up on the Lees, you know, in the mountains, herding the family's cattle, and, you know, cooking over a fire, sleeping under the stars. They're all second nature to him. You know, he doesn't really, you know, cold weather, hunger, they're not good or bad. You know, if they don't kill you, they just are, you know. So he's kind of tough like that. And he suffered a tragedy early. I won't say what it is, but when he was like 11. And it's made him kind of wary. And, you know, he kind of retreated into books and just being in the outdoors. He loves to spend solitary time. But he meets this other kid, Wynn, who's an architect son from Vermont. And he's just like a gentle giant. You know, he's like 6'5". He's sweet, you know, in every cell, and he's an artist. He loves to make ephemeral art, you know, out of sticks and rocks and feathers and kind of Goldsworthy like stuff. And he just loves the outdoors, and he loves books, he loves poetry. But they're both, you know, what binds these guys is, you know, their sheer love of rivers, mountains, fishing, and books.
Yeah, but that wary nature, when danger appears, that wariness is what, you know, it helps Jack. Wynn is yet this person who always wants to believe the best in people. And that makes him, that creates a bit of conflict between the two characters.
Yeah, you know, you kind of wonder, I think, as the book unfolds, I think it's left up to the reader to decide, in the end, what's the better approach and what's maybe even the most effective in terms of survival. It's not clear. And, you know, at one point Jack snaps at Wynn and says, you know, I think he says, you're like a puppy. And I think of it like a black lab, you know, just kind of wags his tail and goes up to people and expects the best. And if they don't give him the best, they just kind of sniff, wag their tail and move on. And I think Wynn is a little bit like that. And I think it drives Jack absolutely nuts.
My guest today is Peter Heller, a novelist, author of The Dog Stars and two other novels, as well as four other works of nonfiction, including Kook, a story of how he took up surfing. His new book is titled The River. It's published by Knopf. You mentioned the story at the beginning that was the second inspiration for this guy who said he'd lost his wife and just disappeared over a berm. A similar story happens here, but before that story occurs, as they're going down the river, they hear a couple fighting. And I guess voices carry on the water along the bank sides and when there's nothing else to hear. And there's a whole discussion on whether they should let them know about this fire that they know is happening, but at this point you can't see it, can't smell it, can't see any sort of smoke plumes. And this becomes an issue too. Do we go back and tell them?
Right, yeah, because they, you know, they had smelled these, you know, sort of tinges of smoke and wondered if it was a campfire, another party, because it wasn't overwhelming. It was just a faint whiff of smoke now and then. And one night, they, the very beginning of the book, they climb a knoll in the evening at night, and they see this glow on the horizon, and it's like two quadrants of glow, and it sort of flutters and breathes, and they know what it is, and it scares them to the bone. But the only reason that they know about it is because they had a suspicion, and they climbed this knoll. So they think that, you know, they're in this really strange weather, something that I've experienced before, but only once, and that's heavy, heavy wind churning up big waves on the lake and thick fog at the same time.
You never think of that together. I mean, wind blows fog out.
Exactly, yeah. So they thought it was really, really odd. And they're sticking close to shore because it's so rough, and if they put on a spray deck, but they have to surf the waves into the shore. They're so big onto these, you know, stony beaches, and it's dicey, you know, because you can break, they have a Kevlar canoe, and you can break it. But they do button on a spray deck, and they're beating their way along the coast, the shore, and, you know, they hear through the fog, you know, what sounds like bird cry or wolves or they don't know what. And they get a little closer, and they hear a couple arguing, high pitch, you know, shouts and remonstration. And they look at each other, you know, well, should we stop and warn them? But it's so dicey, you know, if it's a limestone shale, they can, you know, definitely break the boat. And then they think, you know, well, if a couple expects privacy in their home, you know, wouldn't they expect it out in the middle of the nowhere? So they paddle on. But a couple hours later, the wind falls off. It just dies away. And the water glasses off, and they're kind of drifting on this really ghostly, beautiful rayon-like sheen of glass, and it's still foggy, and then the fog lifts, and they think, you know, we should go back and tell the couple. We'll lose half a day, but they're super vulnerable if they don't know about it. And so they turn around, and they head back.
And they can't find them.
They cannot find them, which is super strange.
And then at some point, as they move on, they're getting ready to go into the whitewater section of their journey. And who should come up but a single person in a canoe?
Yeah, I love that scene.
It is very nice. It's well written.
I like it because what I like about it is that Jack, you know, he's so keen, you know, and he's really got a hunter's sort of keen sense of things and eyesight and nose. And he sees this guy a couple of hundred yards off in the middle of the river heading for this horizon line of this waterfall that, you know, you got to know about, and you got to get to the right bank and, you know, hit the right bit of bank so you can, you know, portage this thing and avoid going over and get into your certain death. And Jack watches this guy out in the middle of the river sort of hapless, and he judges his character in, you know, 2 seconds flat, you know, and he's already made his judgment. Scorn. But then he's also sort of surprised and shocked that the guy's alone, because the only, you know, they heard a couple arguing and now there's just one man.
And then it gets into this nature, you know, Jack has sized this guy up in 2 seconds, and his partner, Wynn, is saying, oh no, there has to be a reasonable explanation for what's going on, and it's not malice.
Right.
One of the things you do in the book is you spend a lot of time giving us a true sense of the land, the stream, and I assume that comes from that journey up the Winnisk River in northern Ontario, but that seems to be a big part of the book, is trying to put the reader into the circumstances. How important was that to you?
It's the most important thing, I think. I mean, you know, tell you the truth, Rich, is when I sit down to write and I start with that first line, I'm really, you know, I'm really interested in the music and the language, and I sort of ride the back of the language into the story, which is a little bit maybe the opposite of the way other novelists work. Others might have an idea first or a plot and bring the language to it, but I kind of go the other way. I just like the cadence and the sound of, you know, these sentences, and after that, they always end up carrying me into a place that I really want to be. I mean, if you think I'm writing at my coffee shop at some little table and there's people all around me, maybe people making a real estate deal over here, and maybe a mother with her baby, you know, in a stroller over here, and maybe a couple of college kids studying over at that table. And, you know, I'm in Denver and I've got put on my headphones and I sort of transport. And to me, that's the thrilling part of writing fiction, is I go to a place that I just want to be, and that's where this story took me, was up into that country, you know, south of Hudson Bay, the Canadian Shield, those big woods, and then, you know, that drops off, the river drops off the Canadian Shield and onto the Taiga, which is more sparsely wooded, but thick. You know, the ground there is like two and a half feet thick with moss and lichen.
So, it's almost spongy, isn't it? It's spongy, very bog-like, right?
Mm-hmm. It's really strange country, and, you know, you see the moose tracks are like post holes, you know, and this stuff. And that's where I want to take the reader. You know, I just want to, that's sort of my gift to the reader, is to do the best I can as a writer to completely transport and immerse whoever's reading the book. And I just love that. For me, always in my books, you know, the landscape is probably the major character.
There's two pages in the book where it's after the adventure is very much on. I won't give away what's going on, but there's some events, and they're having to reassess their situation. And you spend about better part of a page and a half, first of all, describing all of their equipment that they have and how they pack it into the canoe.
Is that geeky? I don't know. Maybe it's nerdy to do that.
So what went behind that decision? And I would be interested to know how you and your editor talked about it. I mean, it was very fascinating because it was like you wanted readers to know, okay, I'm in this situation. I got to look at what I got. You know, I've still got hundreds of miles to go. I got a forest fire bearing down. I have some other issues, without giving things away, that's going on. And, you know, you put yourself in this character's shoes. What are you going to do? Okay, let's assess our assets and liabilities.
Yeah. No, that was really fun doing that. I mean, I just took an inventory right there in that Cabo Beach, you know, of what they had. They had a little day box, they called it, which was, you know, a dry otter box, heavy plastic otter box that had, you know, a few meals in it. And, it, you know, in the book, it's not just a few, it's itemized. And it's they have a signaling mirror, and they have a compass with no bezel, and they have, you know, a little thing of waterproof matches, and they have fire paste, and they have, you know, eight power bars, cliff bars, and they have, you know, and it's all inventoried, and it was so fun for me. You know, that's one thing I loved about, you know, writers like, you know, not to put myself in anywhere near the same hemisphere, but, you know, I loved Moby Dick because Melville was always having so much fun with that. He would just go crazy with, you know, itemizing stuff on the ship and or in one of the whaling boats. And Thoreau did the same thing, you know, when he talks about Walden building his cabin, you know, he itemizes every nail. And there's something charming about it, and there's something that grounds you, you know, with those lists, you know, that just, they tether you to something that's really, that feels real and authentic, and that you can almost, you know, you can pick up part of this inventory, part of these provisions, and just kind of, you know, weigh them in your hand almost. And it's fun to do.
One of the things I really enjoyed reading, and I wanted to ask you about your real life adventure going up the Winnisk River, is there are these moments, I mean, it is very narrative driven, that the plot is, it's a page turner, but there are also these moments where, you know, they're coming around a bend and they see a swirl in the water, in, you know, sort of a glassy, and all of a sudden a moose head appears, you know, and it's that they're going, wow, where did that moose come from? He was deep, you know, and I was wondering if you had similar experiences. What were the sort of the images that stick with you of your own trip paddling up to Hudson Bay?
Well, some of them are really funny, but, you know, so I said it was really my first, you know, adventure with, you know, this woman that I was dating, and I knew she was adventurous because she, you know, she showed up at my house for like our third date. You know, she was just going to come by, drop off her little duffel bag from her workout, and then we were going to go out to dinner. And in the duffel bag were like throwing stars, short swords, and she was studying ninja stuff. And I thought that was really exotic and cool. So I thought, okay, she's tough, she's game. And I invited her on this. I had this assignment. I, you know, invited her on this canoe trip, and she asked me if she could bring her eyebrow tweezers. And, you know, we had these little blue barrels, you know, to put our own personal, you know, clothes and stuff. And I said, well, I don't think that's a great idea. Maybe they don't belong here. So nix that. But how many grams does a eyebrow tweezer weigh? You know, I mean, it was just more sort of in my ethic, you know, it was like, well, you don't bring eyebrows or makeup, you know, in a canoe trip, right? So just sort of puritanical that way. And then, but I, she got me back because she loved fossils. And she would pick up these blocks of limestone on the beach and put them in the canoe if it had a fossil in it. And, you know, the canoe's starting to get lower and lower in the water, losing our freeboard, right? And we're running whitewater. And I remember one morning I go to load the canoe, and there by the canoe is this block of limestone, must have weighed 12 pounds. And there was a little clamshell fossil in one corner. And I picked it up and I said, hey, Kim, you know, maybe it's just a little fossil. Maybe we could just leave this one. And she, snake eyes, you know, she looked at me. She said, don't minimize me. And I thought, okay, you're a woman to reckon with. I think we're going to, you know, this is, might last. But we were fishing once in Maine, and it was fall, and I wanted to take her up there to northern New England to see the colors. It was October, and it was rut season, and we're fishing a remote lake. You can hike out to these lakes where people have packed in canoes. You just bring a paddle. And we're fishing for these old strain of brook trout. It was beautiful, and we're out in the middle of this lake. She said, hey, look, there's a moose. And I looked at the bank, and there's big, big bull moose, and he was tossing his rack and raising his nose like he was sniffing, trying to smell us, you know. And then we kept fishing, and she said, hey, look, he's waiting. And he wasn't just waiting, you know, before you know, you see this rack and it's making a beeline at us across the lake. And he was going faster than we could paddle. I'm not kidding. I mean, he must have been going like, you know, 4 knots. And they have hollow hair, you know, those big paddle hooves. And he was coming straight for us and faster than we could paddle. And she said, what should we do? And I said, well, zip up your life jacket. I could just see the mayhem, you know, when he got there, you know, hooves flying and boat flipping. And so I pulled out the big guns and I just started singing as loud as I could. And, you know, I sang the moose respect song, like, you're the king, this is your lake, you know. And kind of, you see the rat kind of cock, and then he veered off and went to shore, got out, glared back, and went into the woods. But what happened was he thought we were another bull moose. He heard the knock of the paddle or whatever. And once he realized, you know, we were humans, he took off. But it was really, actually really scary.
This book is a bit scary as well, the story of the river. Two friends, college friends, paddling up to northern Canada, and about anything that can go wrong does go wrong in it. But it is a good read. I have to ask you a last question. I know you have done so many amazing things. You know, you've gone on a whaling boat, an anti-whaling boat to break up the whaling fleet in Antarctica. You've done whitewater in Tibet, canyons deeper than the Grand Canyon. Are you still doing adventure assignments this day and age, or are those days over?
Well, I tell people all I do now is drink coffee and write novels, which sort of feels true. I love to surf. You know, that's what I've come, my, you know, latest passion. And so, you know, we go surfing as much as we can. I still kayak with my friends, you know, nothing crazy hard anymore, but just social. It's fun.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's a wonderful book, The River. Peter, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks a lot. It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Whitewater kayaker, outdoor adventurer, and novelist Peter Heller speaking with us back in March here on Studio Tulsa. His most recent novel is titled The River. It's published by Knopf. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs or just want to hear a program on demand, you can listen anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just find the Studio Tulsa list of shows and listen at your leisure. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.